back into the looking glass of Genesis, because I left you guys hanging 2 weeks ago, so I'm sure you're going, oh my goodness, what happened after the flood? Right? You haven't heard that before. So what happens after the flood? Noah rides out this storm on his ark. Then what? I'm glad you asked. I'm glad you want to know, because there's this beautiful ending to the story, and then it's bizarrely followed by this utterly bizarre sequence of events. So that's where we're heading this morning, from the beautiful to the bizarre. And if you can remember back over the course of the fall, we've talked about a lot of depth about Genesis, the way Genesis covers an incredible amount of material and depth. And we've seen that there are these dueling themes of order and chaos at play within Genesis. And Genesis manages to brilliantly capture the profound inner workings of the human consciousness and the complex dangers associated with that. In fact, so dangerous, in fact, by the time we end up at the flood, by the time we get to the flood story, the whole human project has come undone. By the time we reach Noah, the world is full of malevolence and revenge and violence, so pronounced is the wickedness. God decides to leave the building, kind of like Elvis. God has left the building. And it's an interesting way to look at the story. I've been making my way through Greg Boyd's two-volume book, The Crucifixion of the Warrior God. There's some fun light reading for you. But it's a remarkable look at a lot of the problems we have with the Old Testament. And he has this fascinating idea or theory in it, and he talks about redemptive withdrawal. And I think that's what we see going on with the flood, redemptive withdrawal, this idea that God is always wanting to walk with us, guide us, be with us, but if we ask God to leave us alone for long enough, at some point God will say, well, all right, if that's what you want. And God withdraws and leaves the room around the flood. It's kind of like he explains it in a way that made sense to me with our children. So lately, my daughter Eve, 2 years old, she began to walk, and she's been tackling the stairs, which is just an absolutely terrorizing prospect when they're just learning to walk and they're doing the stairs. And when she was first learning to do the stairs, I would sort of walk beside her down the stairs as she would go, but then she would start to say things like, go back, like, I got this, go back. And I'm like, no, trust me, you don't have this. And so I would walk along with her, but eventually I'm like, okay, well, sometimes you have to learn. And so at one point I said, all right, I'll go back. And of course, then the exact thing I thought would happen did. And there's that terrifying sound as a parent when your child falls down the stairs. It's like a do-do-do-do. And then there's a moment of silence. And this is where you figure out whether you made a huge mistake or everything's going to be fine. If it remains silent, that's not good. If they break out into a scream, you're probably okay. And that's what happened. Big, terrible scream. Like, wow, shoot, that was probably not a great idea. And this is exactly what's going on, kind of this picture we get with God in the flood. Kind of, all right, you want to do it your way, fine. God sort of backs off, redemptive withdrawal, and then you picture God coming back on the scene after the flood and going, ooh, I'm not sure I should have really stepped away that much. I mean, if you take a look at the verses following the flood, it's fascinating. God almost seems a little bit apologetic. Yikes, went too far there. This is what God says. I will establish my covenant with you. Never again will all of life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I'm making between me and you and every living creature with you. A covenant for all generations to come. I've set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. And so the rainbow part of the story is really interesting to me. God, again, seems kind of like apologetic, a bit remorseful at the end of the story. Yikes, that was really destructive. And so God promises another flood will not destroy the earth. And some commentators see the rainbow itself as a sign. The ancients would have seen it like a bow and arrow. And so by putting the rainbow in the sky, God is hanging up his bow and arrow, so to speak. No more dealing with the world through bows and arrows type thing. And so allowing humanity to experience the full repercussions of their actions is this, you get the sense God's like, I'm not going to allow that to happen again. God's saying, okay, there will be times when I allow you to have your way and it could get really ugly, but never to this extent again where I allow humanity to completely self-destruct because of stupidity and insistence on doing it your own way. And it's sort of this beautiful promise at the end. It's like, okay, things might get bad, nightmarishly bad, but I won't let humanity self-destruct. We're going to see this project through. And you know, it's interesting, it has me thinking lately. I'd never heard of this story until this year, until a man named Stanislav Petrov passed away in 2017. I've never heard of him before. And yet some say he's single-handedly saved the world from complete annihilation. What do I mean? He was a Russian lieutenant colonel with the Soviet Air Defense Forces, and his role in the 1983 Soviet nuclear false alarm is a fascinating incident. On September 26, 1983, Petrov, he was the overseeing officer at the command center for the Russian nuclear early warning system. When the system went off, alarms started going off, reported the U.S. had fired a missile at them, and it was quickly followed by five more missiles. And the Russian protocol at the time was, they fire, we launch all hell back at the U.S., basically. That's protocol. So the alarms are going off, the missiles are in the air, and against all military protocol, this man, he's credited with preventing possibly a full-scale nuclear war from happening. He went against protocol and said, no, we're going to watch this play out because I think it's a false alarm. And for 20 minutes, he sat there going, if it's not a false alarm, I've just doomed all of my country. And he watched it happen, and sure enough, it was a false alarm, and we're all still here. And part of me goes, man, that gets me thinking. One wrong move there could have spelt the end of the world as we know it. And yet, through this one man, his sensibility back in 1983 saved us from complete destruction. I can't help but wonder to myself, maybe there was some sort of God putting the brakes on and going, I'm not going to let you guys destroy yourselves. And I'll tell you, I'm taking a bit of hope in that. I'm hoping this is the case because right now the world seems a little stupid. And sometimes I think we might need a little divine help to keep us from destroying ourselves. But this is the idea with the rainbow in the sky here. It's this beautiful ending of the story. I'm not going to let this project end because humanity insists on destroying itself. I will not let that happen again. And so the story, this early in Genesis, is really the very first story we have of death and resurrection. We begin to see a pattern play out in Scripture. It's chaos contained. It's on its leash. New life emerges out of the floodwaters, and it's sort of this beautiful ending. But then we have this directly following it. Noah was a man of the soil, and he proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders and then walked in backward and covered their father's naked body. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father naked. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of the slaves will he be to his brothers." It's like, that is just so odd. Let's be clear about what's going on here. Noah gets off the ark, which I'm sure was a bit of a traumatic experience, proceeds to plant a vineyard. When it's ready, he seems to have quite the party one night, like gets hammered to the point at some point during his drunken revelry, he takes off his clothes, he's naked, and then passes out naked. And then he's KO'd on the ground, sprawled out naked. Ham looks in the tent or something, sees him naked, decides to go and tell his brothers. They then cover him up with a blanket. Noah wakes up with what I can only imagine is a massive hangover. And then, this is the weird part, he's incredibly angry about what Ham did to him. And yet in the text, I'm not quite sure what Ham did to him except see him naked. But then it gets even weirder. He's angry about what Ham did to him, so he curses not Ham, but Ham's son Canaan. And the weirdest part to me about this story is, if you look at the story of Noah's life, Noah and the ark, it takes up about 3 chapters in Scripture. The only time Noah ever speaks or is ever given a word is here. At the very end of his story, the only words ever recorded for Noah are words of cursing. And then, that's it. That's the end of the story. Noah exits the stage of Scripture never to be seen again, with these his only words. I mean, it's so weird and bizarre, but to me it's delightfully strange. It's like, huh, what's going on here? So what do you do with that? As I've said throughout the fall here, our stories are somehow echoed in these stories. And so what exactly does a story about a drunken, naked father have to do with us? To be honest, I don't really know. And I've read a lot on this story, and no one else really seems to know either. It's like, well, this is weird. It's too bizarre. Nobody has a great idea what's going on. And, you know, it reminds me, it's a good reminder to me about Scripture. Because here's the thing. Anytime we enter Scripture, it's like we're coming at it as foreign tourists. I had a friend recently. She's a pastor. Her name's Erin. She's very smart, and I really appreciated this. She said, This is the good piece of advice that we need to always follow with coming to Scripture. When we come to Scripture, we should approach it the same way as we would traveling to another country that's very different from us culturally and speaks a bit different language. What'd she mean by that? It means this: we should approach it as we would another culture, which means we come in trying to be decent human beings and not to do anything offensive. I remember when I was backpacking Europe and we had made it to Paris, and my buddy and I, we were living off of like donairs and euros, like that's all we were eating. But we'd saved up for one night, we're going to have a nice meal at a restaurant in Paris. Well, nice to us, you know, $20 or something. And so we had sat down at this restaurant, and beside us was this American couple. And the waiter came over to them and spoke in French, and they just went off. Like, excuse me, we don't speak French, and we're trying to order off the menu here. Could you please speak English? He didn't speak English, so I assumed that whatever he said back to them was akin to, I don't speak English, something like that. And the whole time, they were annoyed. I can't believe you don't speak English. Oh my goodness. And I just sat there going, you are the worst tourist ever. To walk into a culture and be like, hello, like, do it our way, please. And you know, I think we can oftentimes be like that with Scripture, kind of rude and obnoxious with it. Hello, Scripture, could you meet our expectations, please? Could you answer our specific cultural questions, please? Like, that's a little bit rude. To force Scripture to play on our terms is like that American couple going, hello, why don't you speak English in a French restaurant? And so here and in many places in Scripture, I think we have to have this wise posture of going, I'm a humble traveler. I'm in a foreign land and I don't know what's going on, and that might be okay. So we're going to look to learn from Scripture rather than impose our cultural standards on it. Even still, let's have fun and take a bit of a guess. What's going on here? Well, there's one thing we know for sure is going on, and that's that part of this story is designed as some kind of explanation for the long and storied wars that took place between Israel and Canaan. And it sort of serves as an origin story. A lot of times, some of our biggest problems with the Old Testament are what? The wars and violence we see between Israel and Canaan in the Old Testament. And this story serves as a bit of an explanation for why the animosity between these two nations stems from this incident here. And it's interesting, again, that Noah curses Canaan, not Ham. And so this story sort of sets up and explains some of Israel's future. Why are they at odds with the Canaanite people? Well, Ham saw Abraham naked, apparently. But there are some remarkably wild and disturbing theories about what's going on here. And not just speculation, like people who know what they're talking about. Here are some of them. And again, this might have been obvious to an early Jewish audience, but it's foreign to us. But some of the ideas floating out around there are this. In Scripture, to see someone naked is not just to see them naked. Or to know someone is not just to know them, it's to know them. And so we see this in the story of Adam and Eve. Adam knew his wife, right? Which means there's more going on. And so when we see someone naked in Scripture, oftentimes it means had sex with them. So there are these wild theories out there that's going this. What happens is actually Ham discovers his father drunk and naked and passed out and does something sexually inappropriate with him. Or another theory, and this one I have no idea where this one comes from, but it's interesting. There's a school of thought that says Ham actually castrates his father when he sees him naked, which might explain why he's a little grumpy in the morning, right? Like that might be cursed to you. Yeah, well, yeah. Or another one of the theories I find compelling is that inferred in the story is that Mrs. Noah is also drunk and passed out, and Ham impregnates her. She has Canaan, and that's why Canaan becomes cursed. And so it's fascinating. This is very Game of Thrones-esque here when you start thinking about it, very disturbing. So there could be some very bizarre things going on underneath the surface. But all I'll say is this. This feels like speculation to me, so I'm not going to pursue those ideas. How would you preach on castrating your father? I don't know. What I will say is this. There is a strong association in Genesis between nakedness and being exposed and vulnerable and how that manifests itself. And so I think there's something really significant going on here around Noah being seen naked in all of his vulnerabilities and all of his deficiencies. And so if our stories are somehow echoed in this story, then what I want to do is put ourselves into the character mode of Noah and Ham and see what we find there. And I think what we find there is another archetypal warning, a caution, a red flag. And I think the caution from Noah's character is this. When we speak out of our shame, it is often the language of curse. Our propensity, our orientation as humans is to speak in the language of curse whenever we're reacting out of shame, when we're vulnerable and exposed, when we look foolish or weak, we become sort of like a coiled snake ready to strike. And it's this propensity of ours that leads to the cyclical nature of hurt and harm and revenge. And you can almost picture it here, right? Because Noah's drunk, he's passed out, in walks Ham, he sees his father in this vulnerable position, and his decision is not to deal with it discreetly or just to walk out and pretend he never saw anything. It's to go and tell his brothers. And you can almost see him outside of the tent. Oh my goodness, brothers, you've got to see this. Dad looks like a complete fool right now. He's drunk and passed out. Ha 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 ha. And Noah wakes up. It's like, you've scorned me. You've seen my vulnerabilities, my weakness. You've exposed them. You've laughed at them. You've been ridiculing me. And his immediate reaction is one of retaliation. His immediate reaction is to speak curse, pronounce curse. What does that mean, curse? I don't think we're talking about colorful language here that comes out of our mouths when we stub our toe or miss our exit on the highway. Cursing is not swearing. And yes, swearing can be done in bad taste and it can be profane, but that's not what I think the text is picking up on here. That's not what we mean by the language of curse. The language of curse, I would say this, it's more malicious. Cursing is what we do when we look at someone whom we don't like and we think or say to them, I wish you were not here. I hate your presence. I wish you'd go away. Cursing is what we do when we're annoyed by the joy or exuberance of someone and we think to ourselves or even say it, shut up, don't irritate me. Cursing is what we do when we look at someone and we think or say, what an idiot, what a fool, what a jerk. Cursing's what we do when we look at another person judgmentally and think or say, who do you think you are? Oh, look at you. You think you're an artist. You think you're talented. You're not. You're just full of yourself. And see, the language or tone of curse is exactly the opposite to what God does at Jesus at his baptism, which is what? He says, you are beloved, and I take delight in you. And you know, knowing this, I'm convinced, this would be really boring, but if you could play back your life as a video and look back over your life, I'm convinced that we would be astounded by the countless number of times, especially when we were young, that we were subtly cursed. That we heard or sensed the word, shut up. Who do you think you are? Go away, you're not wanted here. You're not important. You're stupid. You're so full of yourself. All of these times, if we could play back our life, these times where we subtly took in this message when our energy or enthusiasm was perceived as a threat or as unwelcome and we were, in a sense, shut down, we were cursed. It's why I like, again, the wisdom of the Enneagram allows us or points us towards find your message of woundedness. We all have it, and the residual result is that many of us have an ongoing sense of shame. And our negativity about others in the world, that I think it mostly speaks with how bruised and wounded we are, how ashamed and depressed we are. I think it speaks to this, how rarely we have ever heard anyone say to us, in you I take delight. Such a rare thing. From so few people we hear those words, you're delightful, you're beloved. And I think this is what's going on with Noah. He's been shamed and wounded, and he's embarrassed. And out of his pain, out of his shame, he speaks the language of curse. And it's interesting because God is nowhere in this story. God is gone. You don't find him in this part of the story. And I think for good reason, this curse is not a good thing. Noah wakes up, and in his embarrassment, his shame, he pronounces curse. And I think it's a perennial temptation for us all. What do you do with your shame? When you've been exposed and made to look silly or humiliated, what do you do? And it's interesting to me how the stories in Genesis keep pushing us back to the Sermon on the Mount. I'd never seen this before, but I feel in some ways the Sermon on the Mount is speaking directly to these origin stories in Genesis. It's unbelievable. Notice how Jesus responds directly to this, this time from the Luke version of the Sermon on the Mount. But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Someone slaps you on the cheek, turn to them the other also. Someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Wow. I mean, this is about the intentionally hard work of refusing to speak the language of curse out of our own sense of shame and woundedness. And this is hard. Really hard. It's why one of our practices here at Nexus is forgiveness, because forgiveness is a practice. It's something we learn. It's something we practice over and over again, because it's not something we can pronounce once and just be done with. Because the truth is this, I think. Life is hard. It wounds us. People hurt us. When that happens, we move into a mode of cursing. And speaking the language of curse, it stays with people. It eats them up. All of us carry our wounds around, and it doesn't even have to sometimes be a word. It can be a tone. It can be a sense that people get. So beware, I would say. Let's each watch the way we respond when we feel others have exposed and played on our vulnerabilities. It can lead to dark places. Or consider, I think, the archetypal warning that comes from Ham's character here. I think it's this. It's not rocket science. Don't expose people's weaknesses and vulnerabilities. The second, don't disrespect someone when they're at their worst. You know, we talked a little bit about what nakedness meant in the story of Adam and Eve, and the idea again was that essentially to be naked is to become aware of your limitations, your vulnerabilities. It's to be self-conscious. And what's revealed to Ham here with Noah is all of that. It's like, so what does it mean to see your father naked? My dad's not here. Not that I saw him naked. But there's, remember, one New Year's Eve, Krista and I came home at like 2 in the morning to our parents' house, and my dad wasn't expecting us to come home. He thought we were out for the night staying somewhere else. So we came down, and we were downstairs, and Krista and I were just talking. And the next thing I knew, my dad came around the corner like this, and he was in his tidy-whitey underwear. And it was just, oh my goodness, he thought somebody had broken into the house, and he came down. And I was like, that's interesting that you came with the fist, right? Like, it wasn't a knife or a weapon. It was just like, I'll take you out. But it was like, it was an initial shock of, oh, and then it was like, Dad, that's a little too much. Why don't you go off to bed there? There's something bizarre about seeing your parents exposed in some way. What does it mean then? What is the idea getting at here? Well, I can only surmise or guess that in many ways, I think Noah stands here as like the archetypal father or parent. And so in some ways, I see Noah in this story as standing for all of the things that have nurtured or shaped us. And I think for those of us here in this room, you can almost see a Noah this way. You can see Noah as our culture, as the Christian faith, our tradition, our parents, our community, the environment we were raised in. I think Noah stands in here as the figure for anything that has shaped us and made us into the kind of people we are. And so to see Noah naked is to see all of those things naked. It's to catch them at their most vulnerable moment, to catch a glimpse of them at their worst. And though it's not incredibly obvious to me from the story exactly how Ham did this, it seems that somehow he disrespected Noah, shamed Noah, kicked Noah when he was down and at his worst. And so the message to me seems to be something like this. If you disrespect the father or parent figure here when it's at your worst, you end up becoming a slave to it. I think it's something like that. If your mode of being is to constantly expose the weaknesses and vulnerabilities of the things that have shaped you, you become a slave to it. Let me make it clear what I'm talking about. Criticism is one thing. It's one thing to criticize. The purpose of criticism, though, is to separate the wheat from the chaff. It's not to burn everything down to the ground, right? It's to say, well, let's look at our culture or faith or tradition or parents or our environment carefully. Let's examine those things that have shaped us. Let's try to separate what's good from what's bad and then move forward to that. That's criticism. But it's a whole other thing to thrive off and live off exposing the vulnerabilities and weaknesses of the things that have shaped us. And it becomes almost this parasitic thing. And I'll tell you, in the whole Christian world, it's almost become a whole industry, a whole Christian industry, parasitically deconstructing the Christian faith. And part of me is tired of it. Like, all that it is constantly burning to the ground. And for instance, I tend to think evangelicalism is basically Noah drunk and naked right now. It's at its worst. It's at its worst. It is. It's at a really bad time. But part of me is going, what do you do with that? Do you shame it and humiliate it? It's like, I don't know, it's like we're all, I've been talking to Melissa about this, we're all socialized creatures, right? We're all products of our environment, at least in some part. I'm trying to figure out how much of biology plays into this. But in some ways, at least, probably very significant ways, we're all products of our environment, our parents, our upbringing. We're all products of that. And if that's true, if you're intent on destroying it, what do you have left about your own identity? And it's interesting to me because Ham is contrasted with his brothers. And his brothers are at least willing to give Noah the benefit of the doubt. See the father drunk and naked, seem in a compromising position. They say, all right, let's cover this up. Let's not capitalize on it. Let's not go out and talk about it and shame it. They don't kick him while he's down. Because it's interesting, he's a passed out drunken fool right here, but you know, he did get them through the flood. And that's not such a bad thing. And so yeah, he's had too much wine, but I'm not sure that justifies humiliating him. So I think there are two fair warnings here, two things for us to watch for and consider as I try to make sense of this very bizarre story. First, be careful when we are shamed or embarrassed that we don't react out of our shame and curse others. That in our woundedness, we don't wound. And second, as with Ham, let's not look to humiliate or expose the very things that shape this, whether it's our faith or our parents, our community. Let's recognize sometimes people are at their worst, and it's best to maybe subtly cover them up. That's, I think, the story of Noah. And it ends bizarrely, but it's going to tie in. I can't get to this to the new year. The Tower of Babel is a very interesting story. And then Abraham comes on the scene. I think there's something very interesting going on there. We'll get to that in the new year. But as Murray mentioned, this December is very exciting. Next week, the choir is going to take up the whole Sunday with a story and song of Christmas stuff. It's going to be Christmas stuff, Kit? Stuff, yeah, that works. So, what's Wintertide? Is it? Song for a Winter's Night. And so songs and stories around that, that's going to be lovely. And then following that is going to be Chipsmas, which I know some of you think Chipsmas is made up. This is Father Chipsmas, 18th century saint who, the rumor is, St. Murray Cooper here, used to deliver sacks of potatoes to children, and so that's where we get Chipsmas from, in case you're wondering. So this is Father Chipsmas. We're going to celebrate Chipsmas on December 15th. It's simple. You bring your favorite bag of chips in a bowl, and we are going to give out awards for the best chips and the best bowl. So there will be the People's Choice Award. Everyone gets one vote. And then, of course, to create controversy, I'm going to select an elite group who will then be the critics, and they will give out the Critics' Choice Award, which has a little more prestige to it than the People's Choice Award. So that is the 15th at Ben and Julie's house. Please come. It's going to be a riot of an evening. I was just visiting. You know, there's a new chippery up in Uptown Waterloo. Yeah. Oh, you were counting on it, eh? See, I knew. Yeah, I was just visiting there, scoping out my own strategy. So bring your favorite bag of chips. Then after that is the 17th. We're going to do, that will be our Christmas service here. We're going to do something on the night sky watch. I want to talk about darkness and stars in the sky. And then on the 21st, we're going to have a little Central Frederick winter solstice walk, which is going to be nice and beautiful. It'll be campfire, some soups, some stuff like that going around. So that'll be lovely. You can see the Nexus Weekly for all the details. Oh, and then the potluck on the 31st. So we'll ring in the new year by getting together for a potluck that Sunday morning, and then you can go and be Noah on, you can keep it tamer than Noah there on the 31st. So, Murray, you going to come and close us in prayer? And yeah, thanks. We'll see you next week, and we'll be upstairs. I'll look forward to seeing some of you out at the front there too. And then, yeah, Dave, could you close us when we're done?